The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this seven-day session here at Turtleback Zendo in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the ancestors in Zen. Let me back up a minute. Buddhism in India was, to a certain degree, practicing meditation. And the Indian folks, being as intellectually inclined as they are, they came up with a lot of analysis and so on. They also had a high emphasis on sutras, the purported teachings of the Buddha. And as Buddhism grew, it expanded, and the later Buddhism, which is really Mahayana Buddhism, Mahayana meaning, literally it means greater vehicle, but the emphasis on the Mahayana is coming to awakening for the benefit of all beings, not just for our own happiness, freedom, whatever you want to call it, but we work to open our minds, to clarify our minds, to let go of our attachments so that we can help other people become free from suffering. At any rate, this form of Buddhism traveled over the Silk Road towards China, and there was a lot of interaction because the Silk Road was quite active back in those eras. And monks from China went across the Silk Road to the kingdoms that were very Buddhist at the time. And translators and monks from those kingdoms also went to China. And for the first several hundred years in China, Chinese Buddhism was really focused on translation of the teachings and study of the teachings. And it wasn't until about 500 years into this era that the person or people, it's not really sure whether it was one person or a bunch of people, called Bodhidharma, went to China and taught meditation. China had actually experienced Buddhism for about at least 250 years before that. So Bodhidharma went, and because of that, even though he was Indian, he was considered the first patriarch of Zen, first ancestor of Zen. Zen meaning meditation, and of course we are the Zen sect, and that is the meditation sect, and that is our focus, is through meditation rather than through intellectual endeavor, although that's not ignored, coming to awakening. We may have a lot of ideas about that, but the reality of it is to experience a level of freedom, even in the midst of structure and even in the midst of captivity, that is beyond comprehension and yet very, very real. And I hold up as a model of this the Frenchman, Jacques Lusserin, who during the Second World War, he was in high school at the time, actually, when the Germans invaded France and started disappearing people and terrifying the French public. And he and his high school friends were very much aware of this and felt that there was something they needed to do to counteract it. And they figured, rightly so, for a long time that the Nazis would not be particularly concerned with high school kids pedaling around France on bicycles. with papers in their baskets because they were going to or from school and they weren't an issue. And so they decided the most important thing to do to help the French people would be to get accurate news, because apparently the Nazi war machine was fomenting a great deal of terrifying propaganda to the French, and so they felt that this would be the most effective thing to do in the effort of helping the French people, helping their fellow Frenchmen and women survive this situation. And so for a couple of years, actually, they gathered through clandestine radio, for which any one of them could have been executed, accurate information on the war effort. And that effort actually, by the way, is apparently still the publication that they established is still up and running in France, as I understand it. I believe it's called Le Monde. And at any rate, the more and more kids gathered. Now, what was special about Jacques was that he was blind. He was blinded in a school accident when he was 8 years old. Kids were rushing out to recess. His eyesight wasn't that great to begin with, and he was wearing glasses, and it was before they had glasses that were processed in a way that they wouldn't break and pierce people's eyes. And somebody shoved him from behind, and he went careening into the corner of the teacher's desk, and that was the end of his eyesight. His parents were rather unusual. They seemed to have been quite enlightened in the ordinary sense of the word, and they felt that he was not an invalid as a result of that, and that they were able to prevail on the school system, and all he had to do then was learn Braille over the summer, and he was able to continue in the same classes as he had been in before, all the way through high school. He, because of the blindness, developed a different way of sensing, and it was very interesting. One of the things that he wrote about was when he was playing with his friends, if he got jealous, if he got angry, all of a sudden everything seemed to mix itself up, and he'd bang into things and fall over things, and it was not, the clarity of sense that he normally had would disappear. But if he allowed himself to stay as clear as possible and not get caught in jealousy or anger or high negative emotions, then he was able to function rather well. He could actually sense, for example, as he's walking down a street, that there was a wall that was 8 feet high at a certain distance away from him, and on the other side of the wall there were trees. He had a sense of this. And because of this deeper awareness, he was the one person that any new potential member of this group of kids, resistance group, had to be vetted through. And people would come to him, and if he didn't get a sense that they were somebody that would benefit the group, in other words, they were honest and true and dedicated, if it was someone that had the slightest bit of suspicion in his mind, then as far as they knew, they were just having an afternoon visit with a blind boy. But others, he would allow into the system. And they had a very well-organized way of doing that resistance group, so that it was sort of in cells, so to speak, the type where a certain number of people know other people who are part of the group, and that's a cell. And other people did not know who anybody else was, and there were these different cells that were limited in scope in terms of knowledge of who else was part of the group, so that if any one of them got caught, they wouldn't be able to reveal the names of what amounted to eventually 500 kids in this resistance group. And there was one man, one young man, who was sent to him, or at least who came to him. And Jacques he didn't have a good feeling about this guy, but because he supposedly came recommended by somebody that he trusted inherently, he put his own sense of it aside and allowed the guy in. Well, not long after that, that particular guy betrayed them to the Nazis, and they were rounded up and thrown first into a French jail, and then these 21, 22 young kids were taken to Buchenwald. And I think only two of them ended up surviving, one of them being Jacques. It was brutal, it was unimaginable, and he wrote about it. He said it is impossible to describe. They were richly starved. There was death everywhere, at the hands of sadistic guards, or being marched out to the tune of marching bands, and shot. Or there was a group of them that worked in the quarries, and it was very dangerous work, and they were often killed by falling rocks. And then there were others that were taken to what was euphemistically known as the theater, which was a gas house. And then there were those who were simply strangled or otherwise killed by their fellow prisoners, because in his case, he was in what was called the invalid's block. This is anybody that the Nazis didn't feel was legitimately alive, basically. And they were people who were missing body parts, or people who were diagnosed mentally ill, people who were of any description that the Nazis again felt was not appropriate to be in Nazi Germany, which they were expanding, of course, in hopes of gaining it all over the world. And so there were people who were mentally ill. There were people who were quite sick. There were gay men. There were people who were missing body parts, legs, arms, and of course then there were people who were deaf and blind. And that's where Jacques was put. And because he was blind, and because the other prisoners were desperate, his bread crusts, what little he had, and they would get a couple of crusts of bread and some soup daily for their rations, and people would steal his bread. So after 5 months, it was too much for him, and he became quite deathly ill. There were three doctors in the camp that were also prisoners who came to check him out, and later, because he amazingly survived, told him what was what was going on with him. But basically his entire body, every single part of it was shutting down. He could feel his heart beating wildly, crazily. He could feel his kidneys shutting down. He could feel his gastrointestinal system writhing in agony. His face was all swollen up with a particular condition. In other words, he was dying. And so they took him away to what they euphemistically called the hospital, which was a square of concrete outdoors somewhere where they took people when they were dying. There was not so much of an aspirin in the camp for the prisoners, and it was up to each person to make it or not. And he wrote that he took advantage of that sickness to leave Buchenwald And what he meant by that was he let go his fears, his expectations, his assumptions, his conditioning around being in that volatile, terrible camp. And what happened to him instead was that he focused so completely and fully on his bodily experience that he had what I am sure was a deep awakening experience. The result was twofold. One is that he wrote, he found joy. And this was not some bizarre mind state of his. This was honest to goodness, real joy. Joy at being alive. The joy at having let go his ideas about what he needed in order to survive, in order to be happy, in order to be who he wanted to be. And he wrote that that joy never left him, even though it was going to be almost a year before the Allied forces came and liberated the camp. The whole situation changed for him. Instead of people stealing his bread, they no longer did that anymore. Instead, they would wake him up in the middle of the night and lead him to people who were freaking out because he had such deep quiet, such calm, such compassionate energy that he was able to literally relieve people's suffering. This is what is available to us, that no matter what awful circumstances we might find ourselves in, that potential for true freedom lies within each one of us. This is why we do Zazen. And the challenge in doing Zazen is that in order to become free, we usually have to see pretty much all of where we're caught, where we keep ourselves from being free. And this is what Zazen can bring forth. And I'd like to share with you as part of this a writing of a Tibetan Buddhist master from quite a long time ago, the same era as Hyakujo, who we spoke of yesterday, who was living during the golden age of Zen in China. This is Padmasambhava. And it is from a teaching, a Tibetan Buddhist teaching called the Book of the Great Liberation. Since there really is no duality, separation is unreal. Duality, of course, is an assumption that it's me and you, good and bad, high and low, like and dislike, and so on and so forth. Until duality is transcended, in other words, we don't get rid of it, we see through it. Until duality is transcended and at-one-ment realized, enlightenment cannot be attained. And that's what Jacques Lucerne did. He became one with his experience in the moments of dying. And as a result, he could see clearly the nature of reality and become free. Both samsara and nirvana, an inseparable unity, are your own mind. It is only because of deluded ideas which you are free to accept or reject, although we don't usually realize that. We think they're fixed, we think they're permanent, we think they're real. It is only because of deluded ideas which you are free to accept or reject that you wander in the world of samsara, that is, the world of pain and suffering. Practice the Dharma, grasp the essence of these teachings and free yourself from every attachment. When you seek your mind in its true state, you will find it quite intelligible, although it cannot be seen. In its true state, mind is naked, immaculate, transparent, empty, timeless, uncreated, unimpeded, not realizable as a separate thing, but as the unity of all things, yet not composed of them. Undifferentiated, self-radiant, indivisible, and without qualities. Your own mind is not separate from other minds. It shines forth unobscured for all living beings. This is who we really are. And at some level, we have a sense of this, or at least a sense that there's something that we've lost contact with that is really important to reconnect with. This is what brings most people to meditation, that or just plain out pain and suffering, and no obvious way out except a sense that perhaps through meditation we will get some relief. And let me read this description again. It is only because of deluded ideas which you are free to accept or reject that you wander in the world of samsara. Practice the Dharma, grasp the essence of these teachings, and free yourself from each attachment. When you seek your mind in its true state, you will find it quite intelligible, although it cannot be seen, and it can't be recognized by the intellect, but it can be known intimately. We are so taught that we have to think our way to solutions, that thinking our way through life is the only way to really manifest any reasonable level of life. We're taught that over and over, over and over again. We're graded all the way through school on our intellectual accomplishments. And so we begin to feel that the only way to know anything really is to study it out of a book or to read it. And of course, it's rather interesting that reading things on the internet is now turning out to be quite a mishmash of truth and untruth. There's a deeper way of knowing that we can open to through the meditation. And Jacques Lusseron opened to that even as a child after he went blind. And he won't open to it even more completely in Buchenwald. It is another thing that's built into every single one of us, and we can access it and learn to trust it, because when we get to the real deep knowing with a capital K, then whatever we discover through it is true and accurate, and we can depend on it, and we can move in the direction it points in, and things work out. In its true state, mind is naked, not attached to anything, immaculate, transparent, empty, timeless, uncreated, unimpeded, not realizable as a separate thing, but as the unity of all things, yet not composed of them. Undifferentiated, self-radiant, indivisible, and without qualities. Your own mind is not separate from other minds. It shines forth unobscured in all living beings. Your own mind is originally as pure and empty as the sky. To know whether this is true or not, look inside your own mind. That's what Zazen is. Allowing ourselves to sink deeply into the moment as it appears to be, and open to possibility that maybe how it appears to be is not reality, but there is a deeper reality that we can recognize, and it will be incredibly freeing. Without beginning or ending, your original wisdom has been shining forever like the sun. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Your original wisdom is as continuous and unstoppable as the current of a mighty river. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. When you realize that all phenomena are as unstable as the air, they lose their power to fascinate and bind you. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. All phenomena are your own ideas, self-conceived in the mind, like reflections in a mirror. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Arising spontaneously and free as the clouds in the sky, all phenomena fade away by themselves. To know whether or not this is true, look inside your own mind. Again and again, look inside your own mind. When you look outward into the emptiness of space, you'll find no place where the mind is shining. When you look into your own mind in search of the radiance, you'll find nothing that shines. This self-originated clear light is eternal and unborn. How strange and marvelous. Since it's unborn, it cannot die. How strange and marvelous. Although it is absolute reality, there's no one to perceive it. And yet it is being perceived. How strange and marvelous. Although it is possessed by all beings, it is not recognized by them. How strange and marvelous. Although the clear light of reality shines inside your own mind, most people look for it outside. And that's not where we're going to find it. But again, we're conditioned to looking outside. That's where knowledge resides, we're told. And yet Einstein didn't study books to make his amazing discoveries. He would sit and allow his mind to sink into a place beyond ideas. And there, bubbling up, would come these realizations. This is a form of Zazen. Although the clear light of reality shines inside their own mind, most people look for it outside. How strange and marvelous. Without going astray, look into the true state where self-awareness, self-knowledge, self-illumination shine resplendently. This is called the enlightened mind. These teachings are immeasurably deep and contain all wisdom. Although they are to be contemplated in a variety of ways, there are no two such things as contemplation and contemplator. When fully contemplated, these teachings merge with the seeker, although when sought, the seeker himself cannot be found. Thereupon, the goal of the seeking is attained, and the end of the search. At this point, there is nothing more to be sought, and no need to seek anything. Although there are no two such things as knowing and not knowing, there are profound and innumerable forms of meditation. And it is surpassingly excellent in the end to know your own mind. How to go about that? The most powerful practice, in my experience, is to extend your out-breath, because that requires that you let go of ideas, of thoughts, of assumptions, of conditioning, in order to extend it far enough. And the way to do that, of course, is simply to breathe out. And when you would ordinarily go back in again, instead, go out a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further. And then let yourself breathe in naturally. And then right away, again, breathe out. And again, when you would almost breathe in again, instead, breathe out a little further, and then a little further, and a little further. And as you're doing that, you want to pay utter attention to the physical experience of doing that. Not to any ideas about what you'll find at the end, or whether you're doing it right or not, but to the physical experience of extending that out-breath with that openness of possibility that it might reveal something really important to you. And if you persist and do it again and again and again, it will. It may not come precisely at the end of the out-breath. It may pop up at some other time. You're washing the dishes and suddenly you have an insight. Or you're walking the dog. Or you're caught in traffic. Or you step into the shower. It can happen at all kinds of odd moments. You just went into the kitchen to get yourself a cup of coffee. And all of a sudden, there's some sense. It's come from that practice, that incredibly powerful practice. An important aspect is to be open to possibility. An important aspect is to tune into your body and feel the felt sense of this experience of breathing out. Also important is to focus your experience as if it is coming from what in Japanese Zen is called your hara. In other words, let yourself be centered. Let yourself be anchored. Let yourself feel your rear end on the seat. And then practice from there. It's a very grounded way of practicing. And equally important, if you don't focus down, you're going to start developing upper body tension from the practice, from any practice really, whether it's working on a koan or the extended out breath, or even whether you're just simply focusing on your breath in and out. So these are things to pay attention to. But as you continue, what's going to happen most likely is that once you get through the learning how to actually do it, things will start coming up. Openness, greater awareness of your behavior. And these are what Shunryu Suzuki called mind weeds. They're things that we become aware of that we really had hidden from ourselves. They're about our own behavior, our own assumptions, our own, way of being, our own conditioned way of being, let's put it that way. And we tend not to want to see these things. They're not particularly pleasant. Who wants to see that tone of voice that they used with somebody that they cared about really was a kind of a negative, accusing tone of voice when we thought it wasn't? And we didn't want to be like that anyway, but to open to those experiences, to feel the remorse, to feel the, oh shit, I wish I hadn't done it like that, is really important. That is turning those experiences, those insights, into what Shunryu Suzuki called manure, fertilizer for the mind, fertilizer for the practice. And if we don't allow ourselves to open to these things, if we choose to shove them under the carpet, deny them, we are doing ourselves a major disservice, because they don't let go then. They drive our behavior regardless. And not only that, but they narrow down our practice to the point where it's not going to be full practice. In traditional way of teaching, people are given a koan, often mu, although Hakuin found that the sound of one hand was more effective for the people he was working with. And that can be a very legitimate practice venue. But when we do the extended out breath, and we can do that with the Mu practice as well, we are allowing ourselves to open to these hidden conditioned habit patterns. And it's important for our own true freedom to acknowledge, to accept them with this radical acceptance that Tara Brach talks about, and feel remorse, feel the disappointment, the anguish, the embarrassment, whatever it is, feel that naked sense in our body. And the interesting thing that happens then is that as we go further along with our lives, and we would launch into the habitual reaction there, it's almost like there's a red light blinking and says, wait, do you really want to do that again? And it's so much easier not to. And gradually, our behavior begins to be more in line with our enlightened mind. This is what Hakuin's primo Dharma successor, Tore Enji, called the long maturation, which is equally important to practice. You can have the most profound awakening experience in the universe, but if you can't live out of that truth, if you're still behaving in the conditioned, caught ways that you were before that, it is of absolutely no use. In fact, it's liable to be a detriment, because you're liable to have a big ego about having experienced that. This is true practice, 360 degree practice, where we open to our true beingness with a capital B. And this, again, is why we practice. I think that's enough for today. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Thank you for listening.